Introduce yourself, please.
Oh, John Rizzo. I'm a state representative for the 19th District, which is Independence, parts of Independence, Sugar Creek, and Kansas City.
Excellent. Let's get started. This is Statehouse Blend. I'm Sam Zeff.
And I'm Brian Ellison. We're using coffee
and donuts
to better understand the legislatures on both sides of the state line,
the issues and the people in Topeka
and Jeff City. Here we go. It is good to be here in the production studio at KCUR 89.3. I'm Brian Ellison, and we are glad Representative John Rizzo, Democrat of Kansas City, can join us. He's not the only one at the table, though, today with our coffee and our donuts. We've also got Jennifer Mann, who is a former reporter, just moved back to Kansas City from some time in Florida. Welcome to you, Jennifer.
Thank you.
Glad you're here. And also KCUR's Kyle Palmer, my colleague and our morning newscaster. Good to see you, Kyle.
Good morning, Brian.
We have all got coffee in hand, are ready to go. But of course, we want to begin, as we always do, by getting to know our legislator a little bit. John, tell us about your family and pets.
Oh, sure. I have a wife, Lindsay, and my daughter's name is Sophia. She was just born. She's 14 months now, so January of 15.
Congratulations.
Thank you. And two dogs, Gus and Scout. Gus is a lab, and Scout is a rescue, a little bit of everything.
Okay.
So that's the gist of us.
Have Gus and Scout adjusted to the new arrival?
Good. Gus is older, so he's kind of does his own thing as older dogs tend to do. He just lays around a little bit, and Scout's more interested in food than she is about the little one. So
as long as there's no confusion.
As long as there's no confusion. Right. No, she anticipates her throwing things off the high chair, and that's the gist of their relationship.
a new food source.
Yes.
How did you get involved in politics in the first place?
Oh, I grew up in politics. My dad was a state rep for a long time, and I had an older brother who went on to, he works at the police department right now, and Kansas City, Missouri Police Department. And he didn't really get into it, and I just took to it like a duck to water and enjoyed it and was just wanting to give back to the community and ran my first election and been doing it ever since.
It was back in 2010, right?
Yes, that wasn't my first election. That was when I was elected. I had lost previously, but then in 2010 I won and run successfully twice now and was... had the opportunity to be the House Minority Whip in the Minority Caucus, elected by my colleagues, and I've been doing that pretty much for the last 6 years.
Well, we do want to talk about that and about your leadership role there, too.
Sure.
Missouri General Assembly's been on spring break this week. Get back to work on Tuesday, but that makes this a good time for us to do some taking stock of how this session is going. We'll have lots to talk about, but first we want to go around the table and see what's on the minds of our panelists, our guests today. Jennifer, let's start with you. What's on your mind?
Well, I have been, of course, like many people, following the religious freedom legislation in the General Assembly, and am interested to hear what John might have to say about that. And I was encouraged to see some Republicans questioning, why are we doing this? There are other issues that we need to be taking up and considering.
Fair question. She's talking about Senate
Absolutely.
Joint Resolution
no,
39,
well.
the measure in that was passed by the Senate over a Democratic filibuster attempt called a religious shield bill. It would purports to protect both clergy and churches, but also businesses from having to provide services to same-sex couples that are seeking to be married. What do you say about that?
Oh, I think that the House Republican leadership totally underestimated the intensity of that piece of legislation. Like you said, this is the similar legislation to what Indiana passed not long ago that said that if somebody wanted to have a cake made for an LGBT wedding or a photographer for their LGBT wedding, that this would put into our Constitution, which I think is above and beyond, but would put into our Constitution, upon voter approval, of course, the fact that business owner could say, no, I don't want to do that. I think that, which of course spurred the filibuster, Democrats at a certain point, in my opinion, agreed to sit down and not have the filibuster continue if they just would have amended it and made it just to clergy, which a lot of people think already applies. I think that was the best compromise. There are people, obviously, on both sides that will call it religious freedom. Some would call it discrimination. I would lean towards more of the discrimination aspect of it. I couldn't agree with Jennifer more. There are so many issues that we need to tackle with job creation and, you know, healthcare and things like that in our state, that this is not an issue that we need to put on the forefront, and consequently has pretty much halted the Senate and their process over the filibuster. So,
do you, whether you think it should be on the forefront or not, it is.
Yes, that's true.
Do you feel like it's going to pass in the House? Will it come up for a vote?
I know they passed it out, I want to say on a Friday. We had a following week. I'm not sure. I don't believe the Speaker had assigned it to committee yet. He may have assigned it on the very last day before spring break, which we're on right now this week. So basically you had 2 weeks so far that have been killed by it not moving forward. So I don't see a rush on it, but I do think at a certain point, that it will get assigned to committee, it will go through the process, and we will have the floor debate. Honestly, the ball is in the Speaker's hands at this point, and the floor leader, and they're going to have to make the decision if they want to have the House be as contentious as the Senate was. The difference is, obviously, that our debates are limited to 15 minutes per inquiry, and we don't have the option to filibuster, so we would get to a vote probably much quicker, way quicker than what they did in the Senate.
If the majority wants to pass it, they're going to be able to.
I will wait to see that. I don't know. I'm an optimist, and I hope that my Republican colleagues can see the legislation for what it is and the discriminatory practice of what is going on with it. And I have to be optimistic sometimes down there, being in the super minority. So I would hope that enough people would have enough sense to see the bill or SJR for what it is, the resolution, and vote against it. So I'm hopeful, but also pragmatic.
Kyle.
Well, that gets to what I was going to ask you. If it comes before voters, if it does pass out and it becomes a ballot issue in November, I mean, do you worry that Missourians would pass it and they would approve it?
Well, I'll tell you, we just saw an issue similar in Springfield. I want to say it was not long ago, but it was something that affected the LGBT community not long ago.
Right. There was an anti-discrimination municipal ordinance in Springfield,
right. Mm-hmm.
But then the voters overturned it.
Yes, exactly. So, I mean, I think that looking at the legislature now, or looking at the electorate now of the state of Missouri, it's in a totally different place than it was even 4 or 5 years ago. So I couldn't tell you. And then you also have to take into the aspect of Trump being a nominee. And if Trump is the Republican nominee, do Republicans stay home? Does that, you know, kind of that kind of voter that would vote for that not go get out and vote for it?
You might be our first representative guest to bring up Donald Trump and his potential impact on Missouri politics.
Congratulations.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's the elephant in the room. And I think that a lot of Republicans are genuinely scared of what that brings to the table in November.
Kyle Palmer, what's your thought today?
Well, not that bipartisan comedy was ever anything that was, I think, a priority in the previous sessions, the last 3 or 4 years, but do you feel like this debate over this religious shield bill, both in the Senate and in the House, but especially in the Senate, has it deepened divisions? Has it poisoned the atmosphere in Jefferson City anymore?
Oh, I definitely think it's poisoned the atmosphere in the Senate, because it has changed the way that the Senate goes about what they're doing. The one thing you have in the Senate is the filibuster. And the Senate is completely different from the House. If the House wants to move on, they do a PQ, which is moving to the previous question, ending debate, and having a vote. Happens very frequently in the House. It's normal. But we don't have the filibuster option. In the Senate, you have the filibuster option. When you take that off the table and you move the previous question like they did on that legislation, like they did last year on the right-to-work legislation, you're essentially changing the Senate to a smaller House of Representatives. So I definitely feel like, I mean, we saw Senator Dixon and Senator Sylvie of the majority party both give very rousing speeches on the floor about not moving the previous question, about having open debate, about recognizing senators for whatever they need to be recognizing for. And so I don't think it's just Democrats that are upset with moving the previous question on that issue or in general. I think Republicans within that caucus are upset as well.
I want to ask you, as part of the Democratic leadership, you are the whip in leadership. You are in a position to help set the agenda, to set the course, at least for your, as you said, a super minority caucus within the House, but still obviously part of what sets the agenda. If you, at this midpoint in the session, had to stop and take stock and say, here's what we're going to make our priorities for the next couple of months, for the rest of this session, what are the top two or three agenda items that you, as a Democratic leader, would hope to accomplish?
Yeah, well, I mean, I would definitely say, obviously, education is a big issue. Underfunding the formula, which it seems to have happened again this year. But the thing on the forefront, the economic tool that we're not using is Medicaid expansion. I mean, we're talking about, I believe, the last numbers are $1.8 to $2 billion into the economy. We're talking about jobs that would be created, nurses, doctors. Oh, and by the way, 300,000 people get to go see a doctor that couldn't before. So, I mean, if you want to talk about an economic development tool, that would be something that I'm sure most Democrats, if not all Democrats, I would imagine all Democrats would like to see get done more than anything in this session. And it's the expansion of what we've already done. This is not the Obamacare that everybody wants to, you know, go around and beat up and everything else. This is the system that's currently in place, that was put in place, I might add, by the Republican majority in, I want to say, 2006. And this would just be expanding that.
I guess I'm curious, though, about the arguments opposed to that, which are, in some cases, connecting it, as you said, to to the Affordable Care Act and a bill that Republicans in the majority don't support and not wanting to give their tacit endorsement to that plan by accepting those federal funds, but also the question of whether those federal funds are really reliable, whether it makes sense for the state to build its future economic plans around money that they aren't sure will be there.
Well, I can tell you this: the federal government has, to my knowledge, never defaulted on highways. They've never defaulted on other money that comes into the state of Missouri. I find no reason to think that they would default without a plan to stair-step maybe out of it or something like that if in fact things were to change. But we haven't seen anything change. We hear, you know, all of these other things. But I think the reason why it always stalls is kind of this polarization that we've seen in Washington kind of trickling down into Jefferson City and local politics. Is I think there's a lot of people on the opposite side of the aisle for me that are in the Republican majority that would love to vote for it, but they're scared to death of actually being on the record as voting for something that President Obama proposed. And I think that they're trying to find their way out of that corner. I mean, at the end of the day, we balance a budget every year. It's required. We do it every year. And $2 billion, no matter how you slice it, whether you like it or you don't like what it goes for or not, into the economy and into the budget would take a lot of notches out of the belt.
Do you think that Republicans would vote for this if it didn't require them to go on record as supporting Obamacare? You say you think that. Do you think that because they've told you that?
I think if you took a vote in the House in a non-election year, of course, I think if you took a vote in the House in a non-election year, it would pass.
But it didn't pass last year. It wasn't an election year.
Yeah, but the problem you have is it was only brought up during the budget, and we still have. We still have a senator who is vehemently going to oppose it in the Senate and has been outspoken about that. And it's not a subject to where, unless everybody knows that the bill is going to pass, that somebody's going to get out on Front Street from the majority party and take this vote. If in fact, there were some sort of compromise legislation, which Jay Barnes worked on, he's a state rep from Jefferson City, some sort of compromise legislation, something like that, and the senator that always opposes it would say, hey, this is a good compromise, and everybody understood that this was something that everybody agreed on, I think the vote would be a lot different than what it's been in the past.
The other item you mentioned as one of your priorities going forward for the rest of this session is education and funding it at a higher level. How much would be enough, and is that even a possibility?
Well, so we took I wasn't there when they did this, but they took the limits off of the casinos years ago because all of that money goes to education, thinking that that would get us closer to fully funding the foundation formula, which is a very complicated thing. Excuse me. And we didn't see that happen. I want to say last year they were $600 million short of fully funding the foundation formula. There's a bill out there right now to lower the bar to pretty much funding it at the levels of where we're at right now. It'd still be a little bit short, but the bar would be set lower. When we're sitting here talking about two school districts in Kansas City or in Kansas City and St. Louis areas that struggle, and I don't see how you can't put enough money into those districts to give them a chance to survive.
So $60 million more, would that even be enough?
Well, we actually put $70 million. I believe somewhere between 60 and 70 in the House budget. We'll see if that stays in the Senate. A dollar more is always good. Mm-hmm. But when you're giving tax credits away to big corporate interest and you're not fully funding the foundation formula, we at some point need to kind of reassess the way we do business.
Jennifer, you're hearing this. You've been observing these things for years, but you're just recently back in the area. I'm curious for your reactions about all this.
Well, I mean, obviously, funding education in my mind is paramount. It is very distressing to see not only Missouri, but surrounding states, short funding education drastically. And this will come back to bite all these states, I believe. Another issue that is of interest to me, because I did just recently drive from Florida to Kansas City, and I will tell you that the highways in Missouri are abysmal. And driving on I-70 from St. Louis to Kansas City was an exercise in terror.
That's true.
So, that's something that I'd really love to see Jeff City address, is how are we going to, and not only I-70, but many, many, many bridges and roads throughout the state of Missouri.
Obviously that's the big thing this session that we've looked at. I haven't seen a whole lot of legislation move in the House on that. You're looking at different things like a gas tax. You're looking at toll roads, different options. Again, we're talking about a election year, and you have a lot of legislators that are not going to be inclined to vote for any sort of a tax during an election year. But I always say in Jefferson City that the best lobbyist that the highway department has is that the legislators like myself have to drive I-70 every week. And we, you go down on Monday and come back on Thursday, and we see it. We know what the issues are. The problem is, in my opinion, you have a supermajority Republican legislature that is very anti-tax and have run on being anti-tax, and you need money to fix roads and bridges.
And yet, is that really the only issue regarding transportation? We had Senator Ryan Silvey here. Yes. Several weeks ago, another Kansas City area legislator, who pointed out that you can drive through all sorts of sections of Missouri and find beautiful, well-maintained mm-hmm. highways in rural areas that are used by very few people. Where you see the bad, I may be paraphrasing him, he was talking specifically about Highway 169, the Broadway Bridge,
sure.
In that particular conversation. But there are heavily used stretches of road, and I assume I-70 falls into that category, that seem to be in disrepair, while a lot of money does seem to go to other parts of the state's transportation infrastructure that some might say is perhaps less essential.
Sure. And I think Senator Silvey has done some proposals, or at least talked about prioritizing. I think that we maintain more roads and bridges than anybody in the country, if I'm not mistaken. He might have said that when he was here. We just have got a lot of sprawl when it comes to highways and roads and bridges and so forth that we maintain as a state. It's very possible that we could do some sort of a study to look at which bridges or roads and highways need more infrastructure fixes than others, and then just start a little bit with here and there. To we had this on the ballot, I want to say it was in 14, and the voters overwhelmingly did not want to increase taxes for the roads and bridges. It was placed on the August ballot at the time, and I don't think that helped the cause. But there is an argument that the voters have spoken on this. They don't want to increase taxes to fix the roads and bridges at this time. So we're in a situation now to where we've got to start getting creative about how we're going to put money into our roads and bridges. And the possibility that Senator Sylvie, has brought up is possibly prioritizing which ones need it sooner.
But I believe that, if I remember correctly, he said something, Missouri is responsible for something like 80% mm-hmm. of roads, which is amazing.
Yeah.
Is there any way to undo that?
I would have to look into that. But I can't imagine that it wouldn't be possible to, like I said, prioritize. I mean, we do have a tremendous burden when it comes to all the roads and bridges that we do maintain.
And I will say, coming from Florida, we're very heavily many, many toll highways.
Yes.
And I will say the highways there are pristine.
Well, and that's the problem. That's some of the problem, I think, that people, when you talk about toll roads and bridges, they still think of a toll road or a toll bridge as stopping, throwing some change in a basket and going through. I mean, my sister-in-law lives in Dallas. And we go down there frequently to see her and her kids. And, you know, we drive around and, you know, they have a sticker you put in your window now if you live there, and you just drive right through. Dings
it
you.
It automatically replenishes your account. You link it to your bank account. Yeah.
And you know, the thing in the state of Missouri is most people, I wouldn't say most people, but a lot of people have never experienced that type of tolling in this modern day. And I think sometimes they think of the inconvenience of a toll road, not just even paying for it. And they think of having to stop. You know, if I'm driving to St. Louis from Kansas City, am I going to have to stop five times on the way there to throw my buck or $2 in a basket? And it's just not that way anymore. You get your sticker, hits you right when you come through from the camera, and you just move on.
Well, and it's a user fee, too. So, I mean, it's mm-hmm. like, I mean, yep. the people who are going to be paying the most are you, Mizzou mm-hmm. football fans, and yeah. truckers, you know.
Yeah.
So it's,
right.
And so I think the vast majority of Missourians, I mean, at least this is the argument that Governor Nixon has made, is that if you do make parts of I-70 a toll road, the people who are going to be paying aren't, you know, the regular Missourians who are just driving to work,
yeah.
for the most part.
Mm-hmm.
And that argument hasn't seemed to stick.
Well, I will tell you, I think that I haven't heard from them, but I think the trucking industry has a lot to say about what goes on with that. I think that they have a pretty strong lobby when it comes to, you know, when it comes to user fee. Just like you said, they are the users, and they're the ones that are coming through I-70 hauling constantly. And I would
also
say,
takes the greatest toll on the roads.
Oh, exactly, and also takes the greatest toll on the roads. So I think that industry is an industry that's very vehemently against any sort of a toll road. So.
Well, you know, another issue that I've been following closely, just because I'm particularly interested in, I've done some reporting on it, and I don't know where it's going to go, so I want to ask you about it, is mm-hmm. The issue around raising tuition for undocumented students in Missouri.
Sure.
They're referred to as DACA students, the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. Last year, the bill was passed by the legislature that essentially charges those students out-of-state tuition. They've been living in Missouri, or they've been living in the United States for years or since
sure.
they were children. And then Nixon vetoed that, and then they overrode that veto.
Yes.
So that issue is come and gone. I wonder if there's, you know, it's such a small population of students that's being affected, and the people I've talked to around Kansas City who are kind of advocates for those students say, because it's such a small population, there's not a lot of legislative or lobbying weight in Jefferson City. And I know they were just down there last week kind of trying to build up some more lobbying support. So is there anything moving on that, or is there still that conversation in Jefferson City?
Well, I'll tell you, just I believe it was we just did the budget. We passed the budget out of the House a few weeks ago, and they had language in there for the House bill that deals with education, and it was the same thing that Representative Fitzpatrick does every year, and it was that no dollars from this House bill can be used for DACA students. So It again was a fight again this year. But when it comes to lobbying, I think that they do a tremendous job. I mean, they come down every year, it seems, at the right time. And we actually had some students that were part of that. And I spoke with one myself. And again, I'm going to, you know, do your second thing. I mean, Donald Trump running around saying, build the wall. I mean, there are some people out there that get reaction from this anti-immigrant rhetoric. And you're exactly right when it comes to this doesn't affect many students. This is not some, we don't see a huge population pouring into our universities that are taking advantage of this situation. I mean, of all of the things that we do in Jefferson City, this is not an issue that should be at the top of the list because it's just not a whole lot of students.
Well, then I think because of that, from their perspective, then they saw it as especially mean-spirited, right? Because they went out of their way. Yeah,
mm-hmm. Yeah, they did. They basically went out of their way, in my opinion, to have a good soundbite or good rhetoric for their base, and that's pretty much what it came down to, what it comes down to, in my opinion.
Well, I mean, is it mean-spirited or is it politically savvy, or both, perhaps. I mean, you're invoking Donald Trump. You're suggesting that it works for him, that it's
to a certain group, and you know, we're seeing that certain group is angry and vocal, and I don't think you can win a race based on that. We're going to find out, I think, in November if he's their nominee.
Is it working for state representatives, though? I mean, you mentioned the representative who every year makes a point of attaching language that specifically singles out this relatively small number of students to not receive these funds.
Well, I'll tell you, he's coming back. he continues to get reelected. So I don't know if that's the exact reason why, but maybe that's one of the reasons why. I can't say that that's the end-all be-all for it, but...
And can I ask what his reasoning is for his position?
He is the vice chair of budget, and he just feels that the money should not go to those students, and it should go to Missourians and so on and so forth.
So, in my opinion, expanding Medicaid or...
you're speaking logic, and it doesn't seem like logic sometimes in Jefferson City prevails at the end of the day. I try to do as best I can of explaining these things on the floor. And that seems logical to me.
I want to ask you about your role as Democratic whip.
Sure.
I think maybe we've heard of whips. I believe, in fact, that was Frank.
Watch House of Cards.
That was Frank Underwood's original position at the beginning of the series. I'm sure that's not the first time you've heard that reference. What exactly do you do? Do you have an actual whip? Let's start with that.
No, I do not have an actual whip.
You don't kill journalists, do you?
I don't kill journalists. Yeah,
so we're all in trouble then.
No, The best and worst thing that happened was House of Cards. When I explained my job, people would say, "You're the House Minority Whip," and they would immediately think of Frank Underwood in House of Cards. And I would say, "Yes, when he's counting votes in his office, that's what I do a lot of times. But when he's out doing all of the other crazy soap opera, dramatic type things, that doesn't really exist." But no, basically, what I do is I try to keep track of members on where they're at on certain pieces of legislation, especially when the majority party is maybe fractured and we can put something over the top or we can kill something. And, you know, I'm the guy that goes in when we hear representative such and such might be fishtailing on a bill or something like that. And I just go in and talk to them and try to explain our point of view and why it's an important part of our caucus and platform and so on and so forth. And hopefully they, at the end of the conversation, will stick with us on it. We are a big tent. We have a lot of different people who have a lot of different ideas, so we let people vote how they like.
You've had some pretty unfavorable things to say about the way the Republican majority in the Senate is running things over there. Do you feel like it's different in the House? Are your Republican colleagues in the House more collaborative? Are they more pragmatic? Are they more responsive to your concerns as the minority?
I will say I think that you have to give a little bit of background. We had a speaker last year who was supposed to be speaker for the following 2 years. He had some issues and incidents and resigned, so we had a new speaker pretty much midstream who is a contemporary of mine. I mean, we're around the same age, have kids that are around the same age and so on. And I will say with Speaker Richardson and Majority Floor Leader Mike Searpoint, who's from our side of the state, I think that they have done a much, I don't want to throw anybody on the bus, but they've done a great job at camaraderie and letting Democratic legislators speak, which was not always a priority in the past, as well as offer amendments, which was not always a priority in the past. We had members in the past that would literally stand on the floor for hours trying to offer an amendment, never get recognized. Then the floor leader would move a previous question, and the amendment would never get spoken to. And the speaker has done a tremendous job, in my opinion, of letting us offer our ideas on different issues, which I never understood in the past why they wouldn't let us offer things. I mean, they had a supermajority. They could have voted down whenever they wanted.
And why does that matter? I mean, if they can vote it down whenever they want, what is the difference it makes to you as a legislator or to us as citizens to know that you're able to make a motion and speak to it even though it's going to be voted down?
Sure. I think in the past the biggest issue was always us coming up with an amendment that would be a sort of gotcha amendment, an amendment that would make them take a really tough vote, things like that. And that was always the in my opinion, the rub. They had such a supermajority that they could easily in debate with the previous question, move on to the next issue without ever having to take a vote on an issue like guns or so forth.
Do you feel like you've been able to get stuff done this session, or that you're on track to doing so? I mean, with this super minority, is there some legislative accomplishment that you can point to, or that you can point to for the caucus?
I think being in the super minority, a lot of times we are the caucus of defense, and if we can slow something down or stop something, that's the most important thing. But it's tremendously difficult to get a bill through committee, heard on the floor, and then through a Republican supermajority House and a supermajority Senate. So, you know, accomplishments as far as bills being passed are few and far between for most caucus members. But when it comes to playing defense, I think that we've done a very good job at slowing things down that we feel would be bad for the state of Missouri. We had a bill just, 2 weeks ago that was an anti-prevailing wage bill that would have, in my opinion, put less money into the pockets of workers. And I was able to get up and point that out. And we were able to basically, I mean, the bill ended up being voice voted on perfection. But from what I understand, the bill's not coming up again. So that's the type of thing that we can do as a caucus, is get up and point out flaws in a bill, and then hopefully the flaw is big enough to where the speaker or the floor leader decides, well, that bill's dead, we're not going to bring it back up again.
I want to ask you about the earnings tax in Kansas City, a perpetual topic in the General Assembly, even though it really only affects Kansas City and St. Louis. Mm-hmm. There's another resolution in the House that would eliminate the earnings tax eventually. 2030, I believe, is the year that is in the bill now. Another proposal out of the Senate side is working its way through committee, although it's exempted Kansas City. We're voting here in Kansas City to renew the earnings tax next month. Mm-hmm. What do you see happening here? Is the General Assembly going to continue to wrestle with municipalities over an earnings tax? Do they need to worry? Do they need to be planning alternative income sources for the future?
Well, I'll tell you, I was in a committee hearing. As the House Minority Whip, I am an ex officio member of all committees. So I can sit in on any committee that I want, but I can't vote on those committees that I'm not actually assigned to, but I can sit in on it. And I sat in on the hearing on the e-tax, which was Representative Haar's committee, and Mayor James came down and spoke and did a tremendous job. Mayor Slay spoke and did a tremendous job, and we had a litany of people that came down that spoke against the legislation that would basically end the earnings tax. And there was one person who spoke in favor of ending the earnings tax. And by the way, this was a four-hour hearing, and she was a paid PR consultant from Florida, and she basically worked for the campaign. She was mic'd up, and they were also shooting video at the same time. So when you see the business community and you see different groups that come together to say this is something that is beneficial for our community, and I emphasize our community because we vote on this. This is something that Kansas City and St. Louis votes on, and every person that's introduced this legislation is not from an area that votes on this.
Can I ask, what was the gist of her position for eliminating the earnings tax?
I sat in that committee and listened to her, and it just seems as though it was just anti-tax, and I don't think that, in my opinion, that I think she followed the script that was probably set out for her, but it was just, we just think that business would flourish more if we didn't have an e-tax, and people wouldn't move away if we didn't have an e-tax, and so on and so forth. That was, that's the gist of what I got out of it.
So it doesn't sound like you think we need to be too worried in Kansas City about the General Assembly prohibiting us from having an earnings tax.
I think as long as there is a billionaire out of St. Louis who doesn't like the earnings tax and is willing to put millions of dollars into campaign coffers and push an agenda, that you should always be worried. We the guy in the Senate that introduced the legislation got $500,000 from the billionaire out of St. Louis named Rex Siegenfeld, and then he introduces this legislation. So whenever that type of money is in politics, you always have to be on the lookout.
Well, I wonder, this discussion about the earnings tax, I think, there's an underlying theme with many of the issues we've discussed. You talk about immigration, you talk about the religious shield bill. There's a definite divide in the state of Missouri, and this is nothing new, this is not a new observation, between the urban areas of Kansas City and St. Louis and the rest of the state. I mean, you represent an area in Kansas City.
Sure.
And you're finding yourself, as we've mentioned several times, in the super minority in Jefferson City. But the rest of the state is, and I think the legislative breakdown would tend to point to the fact that, there's a whole bunch of people in Missouri that hold very different opinions from you. And so I wonder, this is more of an abstract question, I guess, but like, what do you see as your role in Jefferson City? And do you see yourself having to either adjust your values or principles or moving along a spectrum of what you believe because there is that divide in Missouri?
Sure. Well, I'd like to tackle the first part of that, which was the makeup of the legislature. So you have supermajority in the House and supermajority in the Senate. I was there in 2000, so I was elected in 2010, started in 2011 when redistricting started. I feel like they did a tremendous job with their redistricting in packing Democrats in together and making very compact Democratic seats in the urban areas in Kansas City and St. Louis, the metro areas for the most part, and then allowing them to have Republican representatives and senators. This is obviously shown with the statewides. So you have every statewide is a Democrat except I believe Roy Blunt, Senator Blunt, and Lieutenant Governor Peter Kinder. So you have a situation to where the statewides, the people that are elected by the entire state, tend to vote Democratic. And you have a supermajority Republican House and Senate. So in some regard,
are you suggesting that redistricting was done in a way that was not equal to both parties?
I will tell you, I think that they had a very good plan throughout the country when it came to redistricting in 2010.
Yeah, so this is an analogous to arguments that are made at the federal level with, an election of a Democratic president twice in a row by fairly clear majorities, but you still at the same time have a House and a Senate that are dominated by Republicans.
Yes. Yeah, because I think that the Republican, National Republican Committee had a plan on the outset put in place well before 2010 when we redistrict to do this sort of gerrymandering, and that's why you have such a Republican House. And by the way, in my opinion, has created this polarization, not just in Washington, but now trickling down into the states, and has, in my opinion, created this sort of Tea Party atmosphere, which now has elected or will at some point elect Donald Trump as their nominee. So, yes, it worked. And they got supermajorities in a lot of states with Democratic governors. I believe Minnesota is that way, possibly. And there's like two or three states where Missouri is similar. And it definitely worked. They got their supermajority Republican legislatures. But be careful what you wish for, because it also spurred these very, very conservative, hard right Republican dominated legislatures, which are now the ones that have spurred this Donald Trump momentum.
So I guess to the second part of my question then, do you see yourself as a voice crying in the wilderness, or are you trying to compromise with this supermajority that has views that are so different from yours in so many issues?
Well, I think what's happened is you've seen Republicans, some Republicans almost deviate from their own party. So you have almost two parties, because they've gotten so big on the Republican side, to where I can work with a moderate Republican, absolutely. And I feel like most Republicans that are moderates in the House would say that they could work with me. So I don't feel like I'm a voice, excuse me, I don't feel like I'm a voice in the wilderness, but I do feel like sometimes that the far right is driving the train at certain points, but I can easily work across party lines with moderate Republicans.
But I mean, they get punished. I mean, over in Kansas, Jerry Moran made a comment that he would support a meeting with President Obama's Supreme Court nominee, and he is now being duly punished.
Yeah, right. Said he would even support taking it to a hearing and a vote, although he would vote against it. Probably.
Right, and the leader of the Tea Party has come out with very strong statement against him.
Final word from you, Jennifer?
Well, I am curious your opinion. If Mr. Trump is the nominee,
sure,
how do you think that will affect the down ticket races in Missouri?
Well, I think you're in a situation. You're in a dual situation for Republicans, to where if Donald Trump is the nominee, I think people stay home. On the Republican side, I think there is a certain Reagan Republican that you would see, or you would call him country club Republican, that I think would stay home, and that hurts their numbers. If he's not the nominee, I feel like he'll run as a third party candidate, and then you get people that divide the vote. And in any scenario, I think that the Democratic nominee is the next president.
But how do you think it'll affect the state races in Missouri?
Sure. So if they stay home, clearly the numbers are fewer for them in their state parties. I mean, in their state elections, whether that's for state Senate or state House or our governor's race or so on and so forth. If Donald Trump is a third party nominee, I feel like those people go into the booth and cast their ballot for Donald Trump and leave. Really? I don't feel like if he's a third party candidate, I feel like those Donald Trump voters will be angry enough that because at this point, the only way he's not the nominee is if there is a brokered convention and somebody else comes along.
But I have an 86-year-old lifelong Republican mother.
Sure.
And a 60-year-old lifelong Republican sister. Both say they will vote for Hillary Clinton.
Yes.
So they plan to vote if that's how it comes down. Mm-hmm. So we'll see.
Yeah, that's like they always say when I played college basketball at Rockhurst, and they always say that's why they played the game. I mean, we'll find out. I mean, you can have endless debate on what exactly it does, but I tend to think that in any scenario, Donald Trump being on the ticket or Donald Trump being a third party candidate is beneficial to Democrats across the country and in the state of Missouri.
Sounds like you're expecting big Democratic gains in November here in Missouri.
I'm hopeful. I try to be the eternal optimist, so I am hopeful that people in the state of Missouri will see Donald Trump for what he is and decide to be good Democrats in November.
All right, you heard it here first. I want to thank our guests for joining us today. That was KCUR's Kyle Palmer and Jennifer Mann. Thank you both for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And, of course, State Representative John Rizzo from Kansas City. We always try to learn one last thing about you.
Sure.
What song are you thinking about right now? We end our show with a song of your choosing. Could be a favorite, could be something appropriate for Missouri politics.
Well, I'll tell you, I've been watching Vinyl. And that's Vinyl on HBO mm-hmm. on Sunday nights, and that's been kind of setting the soundtrack for my week. So I've been listening to some David Bowie, Life on Mars is one of my favorites.
We are getting a lot of David Bowie requests lately. I wonder what plays in the halls of Jefferson City. Yes, keeps coming up. Life on
Space
Mars.
Oddity, maybe.
We got Space Oddity a few weeks ago.
Yeah, Space Oddity would be good.
Well, Life on Mars it is. Thanks so much for being here, John.
Thank you.
Statehouse Blend is produced by Matt Hodapp. You can find us on iTunes or on kcur.org/statehouseblend. If you use Twitter, it's a great way to keep up on the show and the news from Jeff City and Topeka as well. I'm at BTS Brian, and you can follow my co-host, Sam Zeff, at Sam Zeff. We try to use the hashtag StateHouseBlend. You can find a shorter version of us on the air on Tuesday mornings as part of Up to Date. That's at 11 a.m. every day, every weekday on KCUR. And if you have any other thoughts or want to be on the show as one of our citizen guests, send me an email. I'm Brian at kcur.org. I'm Brian Ellison. We'll see you next time.
Fighting in the dance hall.